Today in Studio 360...
The older you do get, the more rules are going to try to get you to follow. You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Like a pair of blue jeans or cowboy boots, Matthew McConaughey is really getting better with age. And he just won the Golden Globe for a particularly dark, complicated role in Dallas Buyers Club.
Now, sorry, lady, but I prefer to doubt my boots on.
I'll talk with McConaughey about this second act in his career, what people call a McConaissance.
I took some time off, talked with my wife, my agent, and said, look, I'm going to recalibrate, and I want to do something that scares the hell out of me.
And speaking of breathtaking artistic progress, people have wondered if there was some secret device that Vermeer might have used to paint his uncanny masterpieces. A tinkerer in Texas thinks he's cracked the code. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
I've been a poet, a pauper, a penguin. It's not a penguin, but...
Today, we'll hear a concert from inside a 1983 Ford Econoline van.
A lot of my daily routine is spending way too much time looking for a parking space at a place where people congregate.
A happy lesson in resilience and endurance. That's later this hour. But first, last May, we reported on a story where it seemed like David had triumphed over Goliath. David was a quirky, acclaimed jewel box of a building in Midtown Manhattan, and Goliath was the Museum of Modern Art. In response to a big public outcry, MoMA backpedaled on its plan to demolish its beautiful little neighbor in order to expand. Until last week, when MoMA reversed position once again. The former American Museum of Folk Art building, just 12 years old, will be torn down during the next few months. Robin Pogrebin, a cultural reporter at the New York Times, has been following this story, and she is here now. Robin, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, when we last looked at this story in May, MoMA seemed chastened and said they were going to reconsider this previously announced demolition. What happened?
I think that the protest was so strong and vitriolic in some quarters among critics and preservationists and others.
And us here.
Yes. that it seemed a precipitous decision. And so MoMA sort of thought better of it and sort of charged Diller and Scofidio and Renfro, an architecture firm, with reevaluating it.
And given also that Diller and Scofidio have now sort of sketched out their own plan for what should be done, was that process these last few months of, oh, maybe we won't tear it down. Was that done in good faith, do you think?
You know, I think that is the question that's being debated now. The advantage that Diller Scofidio have is that this is their MO, is to kind of investigate things very deeply. And they're considered, you know, very much sort of theoretical, intellectual architects who approach things in a very deep, thoughtful way. So I think the thinking is that they did their homework. On the other hand, they're also, you know, employed by MoMA, and that's the client. And MoMA clearly had an interest from the outset in seeing this building go.
And so there is now at least the sketchy outlines of a plan of, after they tear down this beautiful, new-ish building, what they're going to do. Walk us through that. What are they talking about doing there?
So what they're planning to do is basically use what is the existing folk art building now, that site, for basically to continue circulation from the MoMA's existing building into this new development that's being developed by Heinz, a company in Houston, and was designed by Jean Nouvel. And that's basically a high-rise. MoMA has three floors of it, the second, fourth, and fifth. And so MoMA's floors will be continuous from the existing building through the folk art building. What the folk art site will also do is have these two galleries stacked one on top of the other with glass frontage so you can see in. The one on the street level, you'll actually be able to walk in from the street. The glass will rise and fall like a garage door.
So what is supposed to be built in place of this building is at this stage kind of notional, a couple of glass boxes, as you mentioned. Isn't there at least an obligation, if they're going to tear down this unequivocally really good piece of architecture, that they need to build something as good or better?
Well, I think that is being debated about whether or not what they're replacing the Folk Art Museum with is better. However, even though you talk about this as a universally admired and beloved building, it was also somewhat problematic.
In terms of showing art.
In terms of showing art. I think the bronze facade is sort of universally admired. But the inside is kind of difficult, a lot of stairways, and it's kind of angular.
So they're not going to transform it. They're going to replace it. But it seems to me now it is incumbent upon the Museum of Modern Art, with its art and design and architecture tradition, to create a great work of architecture.
Well, I mean, I think that is the question, is how is MoMA treating this building? Is it a piece of property or is it a piece of art? And certainly the architecture world feels like they're taking down a piece of art. It'd be like destroying something you acquired
right.
for your art collection.
There is also within this a fascinating tale to me of these two teams of architects, Todd Williams and Billy Tien, who built the building being torn down, husband and wife, widely acclaimed starchitects, as the phrase goes. Now – being told, sorry, your building's going to be torn down by this other husband and wife set of starchitects, Liz Diller and Rick Scofidio. That has to create some permanent bad blood in American architecture, doesn't it?
I think it definitely has the architecture world talking and people sort of deciding whether they have to choose sides and whether they can. They are two beloved couples. They're really actually very well liked. And,
yes.
And they were friends.
Yes.
And so I think this is very tough. They were also kind of peers. They came up together.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a real poignancy to that story.
Many of the critics writing in the New York Times and elsewhere are saying that this is the sort of one step over the line, displaying a more general hubris and arrogance and bigger is better sort of motivation on the part of the Museum of Modern Art. Is that something they take seriously? Is that a thing we should take seriously?
I think there is a real question of, you know, it's this idea that if you build more lanes, will there just be more traffic? You know, where does it end? On the other hand, you know, MoMA had projected that would be about $2 million in this in building after the Taniguchi redesign in 2004, and it's up to $3 million. So it's
in terms
exploded.
Of visitors per year.
Visitors per year. And the Met, by comparison, as we said in my story, had 6 million visitors for 2 million square feet. So, you know, MoMA is, you know, it's crowded and everyone who goes in there has this experience of feeling like it's difficult to move around. And
yeah.
So I think there is some real demand for adjustments. I mean, the question is, you know, could they have satellite or, you know, places where they're all over the city? Could it not be one sprawling complex? I think there's debate about that.
Robin, thank you. Robin Pogrebin is a culture reporter for The New York Times. So what do you all think? Are those of us appalled by MoMA tearing down the former American Folk Art Museum overreacting? Or has the Museum of Modern Art crossed a line? Leave us a comment at studio360.org. A few weeks ago, at the end of 2013, we asked you to make a creative New Year's resolution. Write that novel. Finish that short film. Learn that flamenco guitar piece. 2014's the year to get it done. More than 300 of you told us about their plans, and now we're choosing a few of you to follow and nag all year long. So far, we've got a big-name rock musician and today an antitrust lawyer, Adrian Ognebean from Tacoma Park, Maryland.
I've chosen that I want to do 6 paintings and 12 pretty large-scale charcoal drawings. I was a double minor in studio art and art history and was very active in it. I traveled to Italy and studied, did the whole thing. And then in 2009, I actually injured my right hand, and I'm right-handed, which led to physical therapy and everything. And my hand got all okay. But that same year, I also went to law school, and law school pretty much kills all your free time and any creative impulse you have.
So how long has it been since you've painted and drawn regularly?
So regularly, probably not since 2008, early 2009. I doodle in my notes.
Right. Do you have a sense of what your subjects are going to be, what you're going to paint, what you're going to charcoal?
I did landscape and architectural before mm-hmm. in painting, so that's more where my interests lie, and I'd very much like to get back into more of that type of work. With the drawings, I tend to be more just find things that interest me. I don't do abstract. I always do forms and things.
Right, right. And given that you really haven't taken brush in hand or charcoal in hand much the last 6 years, does that make you nervous to come back to it?
Yes. I'm worried that my skill level might have dropped from where I was, and it is something I'm worried about, but it's also something that has been bothering me and I feel like bad about. It's always nagging in the back of my head that I don't want to lose that ability either.
Right. Well, don't worry. Just the whole world will be watching on our website, but it's nothing to worry about, I promise.
Oh, I've thought of that.
Well, Adrian, we wish you the best of luck, and we will be checking back in and bothering you and looking at your work, and go for it.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
New Year's resolutions.
You can follow Adrian's progress all year at studio360.org, and we will announce two more resolution makers in the weeks ahead. Coming up.
All right.
Matthew McConaughey is an actor who's proving he's able to will show business to his own ends.
I got a call from the director 8 days before production saying, Matthew, we don't have the money. I don't think I need 40 days and we need $8 million. They're only. And I was like, well, what do you say? I go, I'll be there if you'll be there. And he goes, I'll be there.
Matthew McConaughey is ahead in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. You don't have to stick around, but
it'd be a lot cooler if you did.
Studio 360 is supported by Nonesuch Records, presenting the soundtrack to the Coen Brothers film Inside Llewyn Davis with Oscar Isaac, Marcus Mumford, Punch Brothers, and Justin Timberlake. Available at iTunes.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The first time I, and probably you, saw Matthew McConaughey was 20 years ago in Dazed and Confused, Richard Linklater's coming-of-age comedy about 1970s teenagers. McConaughey perfectly played David Wooderson, a Texas dude in his 20s who still hangs out with high schoolers for the fringe benefits.
That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
Two decades later, McConaughey has given maybe the best performance of his career as sort of a grislier, older, not really very grown-up version of David Wooderson. In Dallas Buyers Club, the actor lost about a quarter of his body weight to turn into Ron Woodruff, a macho Texas hellraiser who gets diagnosed with AIDS in the 1980s.
Why are we here?
Just for this wine, dine, have a good time, enjoy ourselves.
Right.
It's as simple as that, I promise you, Doc. Come on, try it with me. Breathe. Relax. Smell the steak. If you need more inspiration, just look at the handsome man sitting across the table from you, paying for your dinner.
And Matthew McConaughey, welcome to Studio 360.
Good to be here.
When you were preparing to play Ron Woodruff in Dallas Buyers Club, did you ever make the connection that he was conceivably the grown-up version of Dave Wooderson in Dazed and Confused?
No, and I don't think there is one, but I'm curious because someone else said that.
Really?
Yeah. Now, where'd you get that from?
These guys in Texas who, you know, he could have gone that way.
No, I don't think so. As Wooderson says, he's got it figured out.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Wooderson's back there right now, probably married, got three daughters, and I think he's hosting a late midnight radio station playing his greatest hits.
So this character, Ron Woodruff, plays it closer to the edge in more dangerous ways before he ever gets AIDS.
Yeah, well, Ron Woodruff was talking about living on the edge, and if you're not, you're taking up too much room. This guy was clawing at the edges. And, I mean, not like he was the only one living a wild, wonderful lifestyle, as he considered it back then, I'm sure. But he was also a guy looking for a line in life, looking for a little structure and what to do. He was unsuccessful somewhat at his job. He was a guy who couldn't finish anything.
He was an electrician on the oil fields as well as riding bulls in the rodeo.
Yeah. And at that time, you know, I got a hold of his diary from his family and I saw who the guy was before he had HIV. And here's a guy who wanted out of there. He wanted to – and he didn't – ironically, he didn't really find direction in his life until he got HIV. And that gave him something to fight for 24/7.
I want to play a clip from the film in which his doctor, your doctor, played by Jennifer Garner, confronts the character about stealing her other AIDS patients, essentially.
Roger Thompson. This is my patient. You treating these people?
Oh, they're treating themselves.
With what?
Vitamins, peptide T, DDC, anything but that poison you're hawking. So you ever wear any color? Seems like every time I see you, all I see is white. You got white coat, white shoes, white...
Tell Rayon I was looking for him, and I am telling my patients to stay away from here.
Why?
Excuse me.
So you want to go grab a steak sometime? I know it's red.
So we're dealing with HIV and we have an AIDS drama. Well, okay, it's coming from a heterosexual's point of view. That's original. But this guy is a son of a bitch. And after he gets it, he's not the same son of a bitch he is when you meet him. He wouldn't have got the things done that he got done unless he was that candidate.
This kind of skeevy outlaw guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He was a little Scarface.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, he was smuggling in vitamins and drugs, and he was selling them on the black market. And even though it was Dallas Buyers Clubs, and there was a club in New York, there's a club in San Francisco, there's a club in Florida, they were cutthroat. They were like little mafias. They were not working together.
Even though they were trying to get these unavailable drugs to HIV AIDS
to patients. Live longer and live healthier lives, they were cutthroat.
It seems that you must have filmed Dallas Buyers Club around the time you filmed your brief role in Wolf of Wall Street. You play this coked-out guru broker who shows Leonardo DiCaprio's character the ropes at the beginning of the film. I want to play a little bit of you teaching him your tribal Wall Street trader chant.
Come on.
And they're doing that in a fancy restaurant in Wall Street. Now, that chant sounds – or the not the, the chant, but the hitting the chest is sort of like something my wife does every morning. Is it something – was it scripted or is it something
– No, it wasn't scripted. And it is actually something I do most mornings. What's your wife do?
She does a whole Qigong, okay. Tai Chi practice.
So it's, yeah. It's voice. It's relaxation.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was doing it for. I do it before I'll go act to get my voice
right.
Down low. To get it out of my throat, to relax myself, to
yeah.
Actually somewhat look foolish and make people go, what the hell is he doing? Which
yeah.
is empowering if you're stepping into a production for one day's work and they're all working together already for months. So I do it myself and I was doing it before each take and then we'd say, okay, now we're ready for the take and I'd stop and start the scene. Well, we had done the scene five takes and we had it.
Without that thing.
Without that. Martin was happy. I was happy. Leonardo was happy. So he goes, okay, man, I think we can move on. And Leonardo raised his hand. I remember a finger in there. And he goes, hang on a second, Martin. He goes, hey, McConaughey, what's that thing you're doing? And I told him, it's for my voice to relax. And he goes, what if you put that in the scene? And I said, okay. And so we started the next take and I started off the scene, did it, and then got into the scene. And at the end of the scene, it was like, okay, well, let's bookend it because you just laid out the lay of the land. Let's bookend this prophecy you just laid out in a common denominator baseline, like the rhythm I started. Now you get it. Now do it with me. Now you got it. Mm-hmm. There we go. Now you'll be on your way.
I've never heard a better example of improvisation that works and is important. It's not just, oh, that's funny. It is funny.
Yeah.
But it really kind of makes that character in the very few minutes he's on screen.
The last couple of takes, I don't think Marty and I even really spoke English. It was all sounds and movements and the fairy dust stuff. And so we got into the cosmos.
Yeah. In so many articles and interviews you've given over the last few years, you've mentioned this second coming, this, as my daughter some time ago informed me, the reconnaissance. after a year off from working, you started taking on these more challenging roles, playing anti-heroes. And now we have this kind of astounding run of great performances in these distinct movies. Bernie, Killer Joe, Magic Mike, Mud, Dallas Buyers Club, Wolf of Wall Street, in a very short period of time. Were these kinds of roles and scripts just not showing up in your box, or did you change your criteria for what you thought you should do, or how did what happened?
It was both. I mean, they were not. I was some, you know, I got the call from Steve Soderbergh from Magic Mike. I got the call from William Friedkin about Killer Joe. You know, Mud was something. Mud was around. Mud, written by Jeff Nichols, he wrote that with me in mind 12 years before we made it. So that was there, but. You know, without Mud, I don't know if Scorsese calls, because that's the film that he saw that the producer of Mud, Lisa Falcone, showed him that made him go, ah, this McConaughey is interesting with this. So one, they weren't coming. Number two, I was not obviously I was not a good idea for these directors at maybe 2 years prior. So what I did was I took some time off, talked with my wife, my agent, and said, look, I'm going to recalibrate my relationship here with what's going on in my career. And I like what I've been doing, but, you know, what I've been doing, I feel like when I'm seeing another romantic comedy or action, I feel like I can do that next week. And I'm not shaking in my boots enough. It's not moving my floor. And I want to do something that scares the hell out of me and get in some things that I really feel like I can give more of myself to. And so that meant taking some time off and going into the shadows. Now, what happened in that 2 years? There we go in the funny way life works, and somehow the target drew the arrow because all of a sudden I became a good idea.
I mean, I've never seen such a radical and instantaneous right. transformation of a guy who is perceived as one thing mm-hmm. into a guy who is perceived at the top of his game as another thing.
Right. Well, I packed my back-to-back. Of last year, the Magic Mike, Killer Joe, Paperboy, and Mud, I wanted to do like two of them, and then I didn't feel like I had time to do the other two. But I was like, I need a little more break. And it was my wife who said, hey, grab your pair, man. If you want to do all four, we'll make it happen, and let's get it on.
Magic Mike, which you mentioned, which Steven Soderbergh directed, it was an independent film, but it was a bigger, showier thing from the get-go. It's a kind of perfect left turn from what you were familiar with.
Well, it was not a left turn. It was more of what I did in that for a lot of people is I popped the proverbial balloon. I kind of took some of what was my image of, hey, man, you're in shape, shirtless on the beach every day and going running. And I said, well, let's go to the Smithsonian with this.
Yes. Let's play a clip from that film. This is, in fact, you playing this guy, Dallas, who's a veteran stripper, and he's teaching an up-and-comer some moves at his club.
Yeah. You're not just stripping. Are you all fulfilling every woman's wildest fantasies? You are the husband that they never had. You are that dreamboat guy that never came along. You are the one-night stand, that free fling of a that they get to have tonight with you on stage and still go home to their hubby and not get in trouble because you, baby, you made it legal. You are the liberation. Own it.
That was Matthew McConaughey in Magic Mike and here in front of me silently reciting the lines as his character said them.
I remember that. It was my first day of shooting. That was the one that got Dallas off the ground, and the wardrobe was so much fun in that. They had all these sweats and Rydells and Champion sort of sweats that people would wear to the gym, and I was like, no, this is Richard Simmons meets Baryshnikov. Yeah.
2014, you're going to be in this big Christopher Nolan movie, Interstellar, which a certain part of the world couldn't be more excited about. But you're also in this HBO show called True Detective with your old pal, whom you've worked with before, Woody Harrelson. Your character is this troubled kind of Nietzschean figure in Louisiana. He's a homicide detective. You play him when he's both 30 ish, I guess, and then in his mid-40s, seemingly a different man. Was that part of, in that case, the acting challenge that said, that's interesting?
Well, the 17-year span that you're talking about was part of the interest here. I mean, number one, just basically, I read the first two episodes. That's what was submitted to me, and they wanted me to look at the role of Hart. And while I liked it and said, I understand why they're coming to me for this role, the guy who I can't wait to hear what comes out of his mouth every time I turn the page is this guy, Rustin Cole. And I've never done that, but I know who this guy is. And so I read the first two episodes and said, look, I like the role of Cole. If you guys are interested in me for Cole, I'm in.
I contemplate the moment in the garden. The idea of allowing your own crucifixion.
But you're not a Christian, so what do you believe?
Look, I'd consider myself a realist, all right? But in philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist.
Okay, what's that mean?
Means I'm bad at parties.
Let me tell you, you ain't great outside of parties either.
You know, when you first meet Cole, he's a guy, it's all boiling underneath. He's trying to hold it together. And here's a guy who has to have a case to figure out. To survive. If he doesn't, he goes off the rails. And he's holding this, having a case is what's holding him together. Now, what you see 17 years later is a guy who submitted and said, yeah. Hey, man, all the rough edges are what they yes. are. All right. This, I am what I am in this life. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no, Rustin Cole is a man who does not con himself as we all con ourselves. This is a man with a constitution and a self counsel that is. Hard to watch, and boy, you wouldn't wish it on anybody.
You seem like such a mentally healthy person, which is interesting given that the reconnaissance and this run of movies is about playing not so mentally healthy people really beautifully.
They're not maybe not so mentally healthy, but I didn't look at any of these characters as unhealthy. I thought they were all absolute geniuses in their own way, and I think they're great human people. Now, if I can hang my hat on humanity, I'm going to find what I think is some genius yeah. and be honest. I think Rustin Cole, I loved living in Rustin yeah. Cole's head. You may say this guy has got real problems, but he doesn't deal with mendacity or bull himself one iota. Now, is that a hard place to live? You're damn right. Yeah. We con ourselves daily to get through the day and we slough off some things and say, I'll let that slide.
Yeah.
Well, what if you didn't let anything slide? And you called everything as exactly what it is yes. and what is it. Huh, be a long day, man.
Liar, liar, not as a comedy.
It would be a yeah. long day. So, you know, I mean, look, I'll say this as well, and I think this is an aphorism that goes along with what you're saying. The more secure a man feels at home, the higher and wider he can fly outside of it. You know, I have more security at home. I have a great wife. I have three children. Those are incredibly grounding things that are a natural law. At any moment, at any time in life, whatever's going on, if it has something to do with the family, that immediately takes first place. You know what I mean? So to have that, I'm able – it definitely gives me courage to go out and go, hey, man, I'm gonna fly.
Matthew McConaughey, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Matthew McConaughey is currently in Wolf of Wall Street and True Detective on HBO, and he's been nominated for an Oscar for his performance in Dallas Buyers Club. You can hear a lot more of our conversation, including a career word association game I had a lot of fun playing with. That's at studio360.org.
It's the man in the moon come from Texas. That is where.
If you live in L.A., it's quite possible you could just run into the musician Chris Straffolino. He used to be in the band Silver Jews. These days, he drives around in a 1983 Ford Econoline van retrofitted with a piano. He'll pick up a couple of musicians he knows, park, open up the side door, and give a concert. He's got all the stuff in his van.
The van has got a bike in the back. There's a battery-powered mini-amp. I got my trumpet, too, of course, because the trumpet's actually been luring people in, and it wins some people over. And, you know, I would love to be in a funk band with it. People have requests, and a lot of times I go, like, well, this song's in the same realm as your request. There's, like, one Sinatra song I do, and it was, like, a hit in 66, and it's trying to be more rock and roll. It's like, you know... Let's laugh. That's funny how it seems. Some people get a kick stepping on a dream. But I know I'm gonna change that tune. See, I'm combining verses, but I'm back on top and back on top in June. It's like, I've been a poet, a pauper, a penguin. That's not a penguin, but okay, so your question, what is my day-to-day routine like? A lot of my daily routine is spending way too much time looking for a parking space at a place where people congregate. which is incredibly difficult. The disabled placard makes it slightly easier, but I really do believe in the long term, conceptually, in the idea of this piano van. Like, I one thing I've learned about a lot of things is I could see ways to make this work. If I wasn't, like, living in it for the time being, because when it's lonely, it's very lonely. So aside from being, you know, economically unfulfilling, even if I have every day at least one great encounter with somebody, and it's like a cathartic thing, you know, it's still like most of the time you're kind of waiting for somebody to walk by. You read somewhere that people need at least 4 hugs a day, so I guess we owe each other 68. Just one touch, but maybe we both want too much. Like good is wrong, it's not always great. My friends tell me a drama queen ain't worth it. Come to think of it, we're all drama men. And the mountains we are climbing, mapping more hills. If we break up just to make up once again.
That is Chris Straffolino. You can hear more of his story at studio360.org and watch a video of him performing in the van. It was produced by David Weinberg for The Organist, the podcast of KCRW and The Believer. Coming up, the tale of one man's obsession to figure out what could be the biggest secret in art history. No, not the Da Vinci Code, but it did involve detective work.
This is absolutely impossible. Those two things cannot look alike. The human eye would not have seen the room that way, and Vermeer would not have painted it without something.
Reverse Engineering Vermeer. That's ahead in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Vermeer was eerie. Vermeer was strange. He had a more modern color range, as if born in another age, like maybe 100 or so years ago. These strange little paintings next to the others, no one was like Vermeer.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360. When you go to one of the big museums that features the whole history of European painting, you can see this moment around 300 or 400 years ago when painters made a huge leap. Suddenly, they were able to depict the world with unprecedented realism. The pictures by one artist from that period still strike us as absolutely uncanny, almost photographic, Johann Vermeer. For a while, there's been speculation that Vermeer and other painters in the 17th century made that leap because they invented optical devices that projected the image of what they were looking at, and then they'd somehow copy that true-to-life image. No one really knew exactly what that mysterious apparatus might have been. But a few years ago, a computer video entrepreneur and all-round tinkerer in San Antonio committed himself to working it out. The new documentary, Tim's Vermeer, shows Tim Jennison building and using what he believes was probably the device used by Vermeer. The documentary is directed by Teller, the usually silent half of the Magic Act Penn and Teller. Teller and Tim Jennison are here with me now. Welcome.
Hi.
Hello, Kurt.
So, Tim, were you a Vermeer buff earlier? Or, I mean, there was this big book by David Hockney that came out at the beginning of the century that sort of stirred up this controversy. Did that's what brought it to your attention?
Well, I was already interested in it, but my daughter, Lauren, bought me that book for a Christmas present in 2002. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff right in front of you there that shows possible use of optics. And so I thought the book was great. I devoured it. And then he mentioned Philip Stedman's book. It's called Vermeer's Camera. And, you know, that's where I had this sort of epiphany, looking at two of the pictures in Stedman's book, one of Vermeer's music lesson and the other of a little dollhouse model that Stedman had built and lit. And I looked back and forth between those two, and I go, this is absolutely impossible. Those two things cannot look alike. The human eye would not have seen the room that way, and Vermeer would not have painted it without something.
One thing you did on the sort of technical level is analyze the light coming in from windows and spilling across the wall in his pictures. What did that show you?
This is one that jumped out at me because I'm a video engineer. And I saw this fall off of light on that back wall. A lot of times Vermeer would have a white wall in the back of his scene. And the window's on the left. And you see this gradient of light, very bright at the left near the windows, and then going almost to black in the lower right corner. And painters didn't generally paint that way, and our eye doesn't see that way. And that's what I saw in Vermeer, and I go, you know, how can he do that? You know, the human eye doesn't see it. It's not natural to paint that way.
But deciding based on your technical expertise and staring at a lot of pictures for a long time that that was true, that doesn't tell you how to make the thing, since he left no drawings of the thing, if he indeed used a thing. What were your eureka moments in coming up with your contraption?
So I was in the bathtub and I was visualizing this mirror at a 45-degree angle to the canvas. And I realized that if you could see your subject reflected in the mirror and look over the edge of the mirror down at your canvas, you could compare those two colors very accurately. So you're then able to convert a light color to a paint color.
And just to be clear, there's a lens through which the image is projected. That goes onto one mirror, which then bounces onto the mirror in front of you. That's the basic system.
And what you do as a practical matter is you sort of mix the paint around on your palette, dip some onto the canvas, see if it's right, and if it's not, you make slight adjustments. And it's almost never right the first time. You're way off. And the mirror shows you, nope, that's not what you're seeing. And by working your way from one part of the image to the other, you can get basically a human-made, handmade photograph.
Teller, this is your first documentary, and it's a complicated story to tell, technically and otherwise. How'd you figure out how you were going to tell it?
The key to me was realizing that this was the story about Tim and his personality and what kind of person would take on a 300-year-old mystery, 350-year-old mystery, and actually have the persistence and ingenuity to penetrate it and solve it and then do an experiment that, although this isn't absolute proof that this is the way it was done, certainly proves that this is one way that it could have been done.
And Tim, just to make clear to listeners, you did not copy the painting. You didn't have a reproduction up and just like tried to copy it. What you did is you reproduced the scene that Vermeer painted in this picture called The Music Lesson. So you created this fake room in Delft with the windows and the harpsichord and the mannequins instead of people.
I needed to build that room in the same size and the same orientation to the compass so that the light would come in the same direction. I basically wanted to recreate the conditions that Vermeer had. So I started by making a computer model of the entire room, all the furniture and so forth at their proper sizes. And then I used that 3D model to make the actual objects. So I would, for example, take the leg of a chair, which is turned on a lathe. I took the 3D model, put it into my computer-controlled lathe, and made that leg, and then assembled all that furniture that way. I made the harpsichord, the Spanish chair, all the architectural features around the windows. And how good are they? They're only good enough, you know, it only goes up to the point where it matters. So it's kind of like a cheesy, low-budge movie set. The closer you get to it, the worse it looks. So the stained glass windows, for example, I could, you know, if I really was obsessive, I would have learned how to, you know, cut stained glass. I did not do that.
But you learned how to, you taught yourself how to grind lenses.
I did, because that was key to the experiment. And people like David Hockney and Philip Steadman that have hypothesized the use of optics in painting, that's one of the criticisms they get. Oh, you're using modern lenses. So therefore, it's totally different because they would have had cruder lenses back then. So I had to do a lot of research.
No, you are like the mad scientist in the movie who drinks his own serum to prove that his thing works, right? You used it to paint the picture.
Right.
You know, one of the terms we used for it was Tim's time machine, right? Because Tim had this theory of how Vermeer might have worked. And the only way to test that theory is really to go back in time and be in Vermeer's studio. So when he builds Vermeer's studio, albeit a cheesy movie set of it, But when he builds Vermeer's studio, it is enough like going back into time that the test that he's doing is plausible.
Well, I was going to ask you, Tim, were there moments in this years-long process where you thought, oh, to hell with this. This is just a crazy, quixotic thing. I've got better things to do with my time and money?
Well, yes, although I don't have many better things to do with my time and money. But, yeah, there were times when it got really old. The painting process itself was just exasperating, not fun at all, especially painting the Turkish carpet, which I had to paint every stitch, basically, because you could see all that looking through the apparatus that I was using.
And I want to say about the Turkish carpet, and people can see your painting on our website, studio360.org, as well as the pictures of the apparatus and everything. But the carpeting, to me, those details are the single most impressive part of your painting.
Yeah, and it took about 35% of the total painting time to make that stupid carpet. and it was painful. It was physically painful.
Now, Teller, if indeed this hadn't worked out, what if he had failed? Would you have then made this sad movie about this crazy tinker in San Antonio who failed at his dream?
Well, it would still be a funny movie. I mean,
a funnier movie, maybe.
Yes, Tim's suffering provides much of the comedy of this movie. You know, it's
hey.
when you've watched him, it's true, Tim. You know that. You know, when Tim's leaning over the canvas and grunting and just going, ah, you know, when you're sitting in a theater, people get a good laugh out of that because nothing is funnier than a person suffering.
Teller, you've thought a lot about the history of art, as like Tim. Let's say, as I know you believe fully, Vermeer used an optical device, not unlike this. If it had gotten out, let's say he died when he died at age 43 and people found this and said, oh, this is how he did it. And suddenly it had become public in 1675. Would the history of art have changed, do you think, if everybody from 1700 on knew that this is how he did it?
It might have, although I currently have a different view of Vermeer from the one that I used to have, which was just sort of this, you know, mystical and sort of sinking into the voluptuous beauty of it. Now I still have that sinking into the voluptuous beauty of it, but I think he actually did this by ingenuity. So my sense of him is of a much more intelligent guy. My sense of him is a much more hardworking guy, and still it's someone capable of creating these astounding paintings.
Now that you've done this and the movie is out, have there been criticisms now that people are seeing this first finished object and version of what you've done? What did the critics say now other than, I just won't believe it?
Well, the ones I've seen, you know, the movie's just been out a short time, but people are being very nice about it. And people who before said this can't possibly be, there was no room, there were no optics, Vermeer was just that good, they're saying that's pretty impressive that he wasn't a painter and was able to do that. So people are being pretty nice about it. As time goes on, I'm sure, you know, the debate will continue.
Well, one of the things that we're pretty careful about in the movie is we're saying perhaps Vermeer used this. Mm-hmm. We're not saying this is definite because there was no evidence found at Vermeer's old house that had one of these devices there. So there's no physical hard evidence. But there is a significant amount of evidence in the paintings that say, wow, it sure could have been done this way.
Well, now that this device is invented, will these kits, sort of Jennison-inspired kits, start showing up in museum gift shops? I mean, what do you think will happen with this idea and this thing?
I'm really anxious to see what happens. I don't know. I assume people will try it, and I think people will be more interested in classical art. I think people will start painting their family members, and you know, I'm very anxious to see what people do with it. And it's also a good question: does this help you learn to paint without the tool? Is this a good educational device? I don't know.
And so you finished your version of Vermeer's The Music Lesson. Have you put it in an attic or is it hanging in some place of pride now?
Oh, it's in my bedroom and above the fireplace. And every morning I can wake up and look at it and try to forget the anguish that went into it and enjoy the good parts.
Tim Jennison, thank you. And Teller as well. Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Kirk.
The documentary Tim's Vermeer opens in theaters on January 31st.
Someday everything is gonna be smooth like a rhapsody. When I paint my face a piece.
We love hearing from you about the works of art or entertainment that changed your life. Sometimes it's a movie that blew you away or a book you discovered at just the right moment.
My name is Maureen Roche Sestito, and I live in Lansdale, Pennsylvania, but I grew up in Philadelphia, and I lived there most of my life. I was 21 when I became a nurse, and it was very exciting, and I loved it. But throughout my career as a nurse, I still always wanted to be a doctor. Always. One of the nurses that I worked with, she was in her 30s like me. She had four children. I had two children. And she developed a brain tumor. Within 3 weeks of the diagnosis, she died. I thought, that could be me. And have I really done what I wanted to do? At the same time, I was reading this book, The Unexpected Mrs. Polifax, by Dorothy Gilman. The character, Mrs. Polifax, is actually going through some of the same things. She's an older lady. Her kids are raised and gone. She lives by herself. And she's quite empty and quite bored and just says, well, I might as well end it all.
And at the back of her mind lay the memory of last Monday, when she'd carried her geraniums to the roof of the apartment building and had stood at the edge of the parapet looking down, her mind searching for one good reason why she should not take a step forward into oblivion.
Mrs. Polifax was at the height of despair, and if the situation didn't change, her despair would kill her. So it really struck me. And then she decides to go to her family doctor to see if he can do anything to make her feel better.
Isn't there something you've always longed to do? Something you never had either the time or the freedom for until now?
Mrs. Polifax looked at him. When I was growing up, oh, for years, I planned to become a spy.
And the doctor laughed as if she couldn't do that.
And Mrs. Polifax wondered why, when she was being her most serious, people found her so amusing.
And that's what triggered her to say, the heck with everybody, I'm going to be what I want to be. Two pages later, all of a sudden, she's actually hired as a spy. And it was across those two pages I went, wait a minute, if she can be a spy at 80 years old, I can be a doctor. I'm only 32. And that was it. My nursing degree was so old at that point, there were actually six new elements on the periodic table when I went back to school. So I had to learn everything from the ground up. And I went during the day to school, worked at night, brought up my kids. I was 42 when I started medical school, and I carried this book with me in my bag all the time. At one point in the book, Mrs. Polifax landed in a difficult situation where she was actually kidnapped along with a true spy named Farrell.
Now, just how did you land in this?
He didn't know what to make of her because he was your classic spy. Like if you imagine 007, young, handsome, and here he is tied up with this little old lady from New Jersey.
The question startled Mrs. Polifax. She thought to herself, it's true that I haven't the slightest idea what's ahead for me, but I asked for a little adventure, and it's precisely what I'm having.
One night, we had a patient that was really sick in the ICU. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was freezing and standing on a stool with this big needle catheter going into this woman's chest, and I thought, my hands have such bad arthritis. I really shouldn't be doing this.
She felt at once calmed and unafraid. I don't think it really matters how I got here.
That's what I kept thinking when I was doing it. I felt at once calm and unafraid because it didn't really matter how I got there. That's exactly how I felt. And then I did what I had to do. This book, I've actually have bought copies of this book and keep them in my office so I can give them out to people who are having just a really difficult time. I tell them that the journey of life is still very difficult, but that if they don't take the journey, if they just stop and freeze, then where will they be tomorrow?
Maureen Sestito listens to Studio 360 on WHYY from Lansdale, Pennsylvania. Sharon Mashihi produced our story, and Ray C. Wright was the voice of Mrs. Polifax. Is there some book or movie or play or song or any other work of art that changed your life? Tell us about it at studio360.org, and we may give you a call. And that's it for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. Stay in touch during the week. We are on Facebook and Twitter. That's at KB Anderson, Anderson with an E, and at Studio 360 Show. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
Special thanks, as always, to Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You are living in an episode of Star Trek every day of your life.
Kirk here.
Scotty here, Captain.
Think about it. The communicator could only talk to other members of the Enterprise crew. They should have been able to talk to anybody in the universe.
Inventing the cell phone and other feats of science fiction. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.